This program is brought to you by the Genesis Communications Network, a world leader in talk radio since 1998. Visit GCNlive.com today.
Welcome back to the Paracast, the gold standard of paranormal radio. And now, here's Gene Steinberg.
Okay, so right now you're showing that in the Levelland case, a lot more people apparently saw something than was originally reported. And you mentioned something about 1975, 2 years before this case. What was that, Kevin?
Well, in 1975, Don Berliner had interviewed the sheriff. And so the sheriff is telling him what he had seen and how he reacted to it. And the sheriff was retired by this time. And he told Berliner a little bit more than he had said or was recorded as saying by the Air Force. If you look at the Air Force statement, it doesn't match what Berliner got from the sheriff. But more importantly, in the days prior to the Air Force investigator showing up, you had some reporters talking to the sheriff. And he's telling these reporters the same thing that he told Berliner. So you have an Air Force report that's been manipulated. So that it's not the sheriff seeing the flying saucer or the UFO close to the ground. It's him seeing a streak of light off in the distance, and it's no big deal. So you can see the way the information is been manipulated. But if you delve deeper into this case, you find an awful lot of interesting things going on. There was a report of landings. The sheriff and the provost marshal from Reese Air Force Base. Now, Reese Air Force Base, of course, is in Lubbock, Texas. And Lubbock, Texas is, what, 15 minutes from Levelland, something like that. You had Air Force officers coming out with the sheriff. They were out looking for the burned area. Now, the report is they didn't find it. But later on, when Don Berlinson, too many Dons in the show, Don Kehoe, Don Berliner, Don Berlinson, when he interviewed the widow of the sheriff and the sheriff's daughter, they talked about the sheriff finding a burned area, a circular burned area. I think it was north of Levelland. Not only do we have it interacting with the environment by stalling the car engines, we also have a burned area. We have witnesses to that. We have witnesses to the object and its the way it operated on the ground and all of that sort of thing. And yet, when you take a look at the Air Force file, they talked to six people. Of those six, three saw an object. The other three didn't have quite the experiences that those first three did. And one of the people they talked to was the sheriff, and he was talking about a streak of light in the distance. Well, that clearly was set up because of what the Air Force NCO wanted him to say, because we know what he said prior to his arrival and what he said much later about what he had seen. So you've got a great series of sightings. The Condon Committee mentions the Levelland sightings once in the massive report saying we didn't do anything with that because it had been 10 years ago and we couldn't find the cars. They were talking about what they wanted to do was do a magnetic mapping of the cars. How you do it is you place a magnet on the car and see which way north points on it, and you map it in different places so you can get readings of how the metal in the car affects the compass. And then if it's exposed to a massive electromagnetic effect, that should change the mapping of the car. They said, well, we couldn't find the cars, and they didn't bother to interview any of the people. They just let it go at that. Instead, they talked to two people whose UFO sightings with electromagnetic effects weren't all that great. But when you take a look at the totality of the case, there's a great deal of evidence there for something extremely unusual happening around Levelland, Texas. A couple days later, there was another sighting by a number of people near Oro Grande, New Mexico, which is probably 4 hours from Levelland. But it's, I mean, the same sort of area. You've got sightings in the panhandle of Texas near Amarillo and Canadian Texas prior to the Levelland sightings on November 2nd. You've got sightings there. You've got sightings all around the area. So you've got some very good sightings. And part of it was complicated by a guy named Reinhold Schmidt. And I bring that up for Kurt Collins because he diverted attention to Nebraska from Levelland and came up with the cockamamie story that got the interest of the newspaper. Kurt, you can explain that much better than I can.
Well, just as where it relates to Levelland, he claimed he saw this oval UFO and he experienced car trouble when he was near it. So it's similar in that regards, but then his was a contactee story when he met people from out, well, he didn't say they were from outer space originally. He's, in fact, he said they had a German accent, but as his series of adventures continued later, they were from Saturn. It was a big event in the press, and as they investigated his background, they found him to have a criminal past. They put him under a psychological watch, and so he, in at least in some UFO circles, was portrayed as a victim of the cover-up, whereas he was just really a shady character, and they weren't sure if he had all his marbles. So he kind of monkeyed with the press on the Levland story. So before we get back into the story there, I think a lot of this, the information that we have, is due to kind of faulty investigation from the Air Force. And I was kind of under the impression that when the phone rang at Dayton, that they sent out somebody from the closest base, but that's not always the case. So, and you say this investigator only spent a few short hours and couldn't have possibly gotten all the witnesses. And I just wanted you to kind of contrast this with how do they usually do it? And was this much worse than normal?
What they did was officially what they would do. They would send out an investigator. I think at the time it was the 1006th Air Intelligence Service Squadron with its headquarters in Colorado Springs, but they had units all around the United States. It was an intelligence gathering organization. But they had guys at Reese Air Force Base, which is not all that far from it's in Lubbock, which is not all that far from Levelland. But and you know, end up getting into things that I would wish people would buy the book and find out.
Sure. Okay.
But the guys from the base that night, that when all this was going on, they showed up in Levelland. The sheriff had sort of a convoy with him. He was in his car, his police car, with one of his deputies. There was a state police car behind him. I think they call it the Texas Department of Public Safety. I know they call it that now. I think they called it that in 1957 as well. And then there was a third car with Air Force officers in it. So now what you have is the official story is that the sheriff saw this object in the distance, and that's where the end of it. But there's Air Force officers who were with him, so they would have seen the object in the distance, and if they got close enough to see the shape, there is nothing that I can find that talks about what those Air Force officers saw and what interrogations they went through and what reports they may have filed. It's not in the Project Blue Book files. Clearly, the guy sent from Colorado Springs, he didn't talk to those guys because it's not in his report. Or maybe he did. Maybe he went over to Reese Air Force Base and spent a couple hours talking to those guys and then went back to Levelland and said, adios, muchachos, and went on home. But those sorts of things that you find, you find an interesting case from the 1960s, for example, and you have Hector Quintanilla, who is the chief of Project Blue Book at the time. He's phoning it in. He's calling them and interviewing them on the phone, and they're not getting any good information from people on scene. There's any number of proposals on sending people out. Arthur Exxon, General Exxon, who was the commander of the base at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, and so people understand this, he was not the senior officer on the base. He didn't command the whole thing. He was like the mayor. He took care of the facilities. He took care of those sorts of things. And in fact, in the Army, they now call it the mayor's cell. The guy is the base commander is in the mayor's cell, and he takes care of that sort of thing. Granted, Exxon was a high-ranking officer at the base, but he told both Don and me, Don Schmidt and me, that he would periodically get a call, and he would be told to get an airplane ready, and then some guys would show up, maybe from Washington, D.C. They'd get on the airplane, and they would deploy from Dayton, Ohio, out to a UFO sighting, and then they would come back to Dayton. So if you've got reporters following the trail, they left from Dayton, then he went back to Dayton. The fact that they actually deployed originally from Washington, D.C. and probably went back there is lost in the translation. Yeah, these guys came back here, and here's a report that they didn't find anything interesting. So you can see that they were kind of manipulating the situation in that sense as well. And that's where we get into the idea of these guys from Reese Air Force Base being involved in it much more heavily. But where did those reports go? I couldn't find them in my searches for it. You look at the Project Blue Book files, and there's no hint of them talking to their guys who were there, and it's reported in the newspapers that these officers were there in 1957. All we hear about is the provost marshal who accompanied the sheriff the next day out looking for the landing sites.
Let's continue with Kevin, Gene, and Kurt. You're in
the Paracast.
Hey, listeners. I want you to have the entire Paracast experience. So I'd like to tell you about After the Paracast. After the Paracast is an exclusive feature for subscribers to the Paracast Plus. With After the Paracast, you never know what's going to happen next. After the Paracast features color commentary, special interviews, and further conversations with Paracast guests. With Paracast Plus, you can download a very special enhanced version of the Paracast also. We do offer exclusive music, videos, and more features are coming. To get more info about subscribing, please visit theparacast.plus. Once again, theparacast.plus. Prices are just $1.50 a week, less than a cup of coffee at your local convenience store. Check out theparacast.plus to learn more about Paracast Plus.
Now with orders to stay at home, public health concerns, the reality of illness due to pathogens and viruses, your health is at an all-time high risk. That's why it's critical to take a proactive approach to boost your immune system. You can with new nano colloidal silver from Americare. Our patented process with tiny silver particles, 1/100th the size of a red blood cell, allows for maximum body absorption. Americare's nano colloidal silver effectively disinfects your body internally, attacking pathogens and viruses while supercharging your immune system. Colloidal silver is antibacterial and antiviral. Simply put, it prohibits bacterial respiration, suffocating viral cells, preventing the virus from replicating. And now, due to public health concern, Americare is authorized to offer our lowest and best price ever, around $1 a day, but supplies are limited. Purchase nanocolloidal silver now at immunesupportnow.com. That's immunesupportnow.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. Supplies are limited.
Anytime, any place, anywhere. Radio remains the most intimate of all forms of media. At home, at work, in the car, on smartphones. Over 90% of consumers still listen to radio every week. That makes choosing radio as a place to advertise your business one of the best decisions you can make. Email advertise@gcnlive.com and partner up with an experienced GCN representative. Advertise@gcnlive.com. Easy, affordable, effective.
Get healthy, not high, with 100% pure CBD powerful natural pain relief from Veterans Vitality. GCN listeners, have you ever thought about how CBD may help you? I'm sure you have heard about the many benefits of CBD. Well, here's your opportunity to try before you buy. Created by veterans and for everyone who deserves better choices, our CBD is derived from organic hemp, grown in the USA, and third-party tested. Veterans Vitality CBD saves you as much as 25 to 50% over our competition, and a portion of all sales is contributed to veteran nonprofits and events. Many of our customers have experienced improved quality of life, help with anxiety, PTSD, and overall well-being. Our products do not contain THC. They are safe, non-addictive, effective, and 100% legal. GCN listeners, get your free trial bottle of premium CBD by simply paying shipping and handling at GCNFreeCBD.com. That's GCNFreeCBD.com. Again, GCNFreeCBD.com. Offered by Veterans Vitality Premium CBD.
Do the letters IRS give you anxiety? I'm Dan Pilla. I've defended people from the IRS for more than 40 years. My book, How to Get Tax Amnesty, created the tax resolution industry and is responsible for helping hundreds of thousands of people. It can help you too. If you're a non-filer or facing IRS enforcement right now, your case is unique. You need real help, not cookie cutter advice. My clients get my personal attention. Buy my book at danpilla.com and get a free consultation directly with me. That's danpilla.com. Let's start solving your tax problem right now.
We'd like to hear from you. If you have a comment or question about the Paracast, send it to news@theparacast.com. That's news@theparacast.com. And don't forget to visit our famous Paracast community forums at forum.theparacast.com.
So we're trying to assemble the details of Levelland, Texas from 1957. It's the topic of his current book, for Flying Disc Press. Kevin Randall, go ahead, please.
The point simply is, we know that the Air Force officers were involved, but we can't find the reports. The sheriff, and I hesitate to mention this and giving away too much of the book, but the next day after November 3rd, and Don Burlinson is the one who found this information after talking to a number of people in Leveland, the next day the sheriff takes his car, his police car, into the police mechanic and wants it looked at, see if there's anything wrong with it. And you have to ask yourself, why? Why would he do that? What happened? And that tells me that his car was stalled. He got close enough to it that the car engine stalled, and he was taking it to the mechanic looking for a mechanical reason that the car stalled, to see if there was something wrong with the car. There would be no reason to do it if his car hadn't stalled. And if his car stalled, then so did the car behind him and the car behind that, and that would have been the Air Force officers. So they all had a good look at it, and they all were in cars that were probably stalled by it, but the Air Force NCO came to investigate it, never talked to the Air Force officers, and never got that story from the sheriff. Or maybe he got the story from the sheriff when he was told not to do it.
You've mentioned a couple of times what they saw. Now, this is the textbook case for electromagnetic effects, but tell us a little bit about the best description of the UFO, because it wasn't a typical saucer, as I understand.
It was egg-shaped and sometimes called torpedo-shaped, and I always thought that that was based on the angle that it was seen. I mean, if you look at a sort of a torpedo shape on the ground and you look at it from a specific angle, it's going to take on a more egg-shaped type of look to it. It was seen by a number of people close to the ground, close enough to stall the car engines, starting at, I think, around 10:30 at night on November 2nd, 1957, when a fellow named Pedro Saucedo, and the problem there is Saucedo is spelled an awful lot like saucer, so of course the news reporters are now taking cheap shots at the guy's name, but he reported that his pickup truck had been stalled, and he was so frightened by what happened, he dived out of the pickup truck, rolled underneath it to protect himself. The passenger just sat there stunned, paralyzed by what he was seeing, and the object was a bright blue when it landed, but turned to a bright red, bright orange red when it took off. They were so frightened by what they'd seen, they didn't go to Leveland. They went to another close-by town and called the sheriff and reported that. And, of course, the first thing that happens is the sheriff dispatcher thought they were drunk and didn't want anything to do with it. But then they started getting additional phone calls from other people telling them virtually the same thing. And this all took place over about 2.5 hours in a time when we didn't have cell phones. We didn't have instant messenger. We didn't have instant communication, so that Pedro Saucedo couldn't get on his Facebook account or his Instagram account and say, boy, you people just won't believe what I just saw. So you had a lot of people reporting the same sort of phenomenon over a period of 2 hours without access to all the information. And that's why I say they were independent witnesses, which makes it much more important. But they're reporting the same sorts of phenomenon with the stalling of the car engines. This goes on for around 2 hours. And then the emphasis sort of shifts to White Sands Missile Range, which is near Oro Grande, by the way, where another great car stalling took place. But we had MPs see an object close to the ground. They didn't get close enough for their Jeep engines to stall. But what you see there is the Air Force smearing these guys by reporting the UFO, saying, well, they saw Venus or they saw the moon, and they got caught in the hysteria of the flying saucer sightings. How? There's been no news media covering this when they went out and made their sightings. And they said, well, you know, these guys are just young guys, not well trained. They were 20 years old, 21 years old. And I'm thinking, you know, when I was in Vietnam, I was 19 years old and I was an aircraft commander, putting a lot of authority in my young hands. They certainly trusted me with that. But the Air Force is smearing the guys because of their young age and their high school diplomas. That's what I had in Vietnam, was a high school diploma type thing. So I was a little bit more sympathetic to the age of these guys. In fact, just in Vietnam, we had a guy we called Papa, one of the senior helicopter pilots, and he was 23. Gives you an idea of the age of the pilots. But the point simply is, you see the Air Force smearing those guys with faulty explanations, and then a day or so later, you have a guy named Stokes seeing the thing near Oro Grande, and he actually manifests a slight sunburn type effect on it. At the time, the Lorenzans from the Aerophenomena Research Organization, I think, lived in Alamogordo and was friends with Stokes, James Stokes, and got him to, they interviewed him and saw the slight burn. The Air Force then tried to smear him as well. So you've got to take a look at all of that sort of information and realize that it was impossible for it all to get out at the time, given the circumstances of the situation.
Now, you mentioned age. Now, it was Stokes, wasn't he quite a bit older than those young guys you mentioned?
Stokes was retired Navy, and he had worked at Alamogordo for, I think, 18 months or something. He was an engineer. And everybody called him an engineer, and the Air Force said, well, he didn't have an engineering degree, and he'd been at a NCO in the Navy and this sort of thing. And everybody, it was kind of funny because some of the letters from the Air Force personnel that worked with him were very complimentary about his abilities and thought of him as an engineer, and the work he was doing was called the job title called him an engineer. So you see the kind of smear the Air Force is trying to level against these people to kind of reduce the credibility of them rather than investigating what they had to say and see if we could find out a little bit more information. But yeah, Stokes was quite a bit older than the people. And of course, Pedro Saucedo had been a veteran of the Korean War, which had been over for 4 years. I think he was around 30, if I remember correctly. The sheriff, of course, was older, and some of the other witnesses were much older. I was just looking at the way the Air Force attempted to smear the guys in at White Sands Missile Range.
To smear their own, that's amazing. So this seems like one of the cases that if there is UFO cases that go in history books, that this ought to be in the top five for sure. This is a well-documented event. And your book has, we should mention it has pictures, so you can see who you're talking about, newspaper clippings, and an extensive appendices with the directory of cases and, oh, there was something else good in there. What else did you have?
A lot of good stuff. I want to say one thing. One of the people that reviewed one of my earlier books was mad there weren't enough pictures. And I'm thinking, the point is not the pictures. So there's plenty of pictures in there. And documentation as well from the Air Force files and things like that, showing exactly what was said and who said what and documenting it all that way so we can see where we are on that. It also lists the source material so that you can see if I say something that the sheriff said he saw a football shaped object brightly glowing red, where did that information come from? Well, that came from this newspaper and that newspaper and a lot of things like that as well. So you can go look that newspaper up and see if I reported precisely what they said. But there's also a long, as you said, an appendix that lists cases of electromagnetic effects. Most of them deal with car engines, but there's other manifestations of the electromagnetic effects, and I have a number of those as well, you know, knocking radio stations off the air, interference or disturbing animals in cases like that. So there's that sort of thing. And the first case of electromagnetic effects reported was from 1909.
Let's do our break here. More to come with Kevin, Gene, and Kurt Turin,
the Paracast.
For listening to GCN. Be sure to visit GCNlive.com today.
Complement your health with hemp-derived cannabinoid oil. We've always believed that the closer to Earth, the better it is for our bodies. Our hemp-derived cannabinoid oil is phytocannabinoid-rich, full-spectrum, and organically grown. Finally, hemp made easy, clean, and effective. GCNHemp.com or call 877-878-4203. That's right, we cut through the red tape. It's now available at GCNHemp.com or call 877-878-4203.
Are you curious about what might be missing from your diet and supplement choices? Take a free health assessment to identify your possible nutrient deficiencies. As a certified holistic health coach, I will help you assess and prioritize a supplement program based on Dr. Wallach's recommendations. Call Linda at 833-VITAL-90. That number to call is 833-848-2590. That's 833-VITAL-90.
USA Radio News with Wendy King.
The government is now sending weaponry to Ukraine as part of the first shipment of security assistance to defend against a possible Russian invasion. President Biden recently directed the shipment, which arrived in Ukraine on Friday night. Secretary of State Antony Blinken met with Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov in Geneva, Switzerland. Both agreed to continue talking, but didn't reach any other agreements. Blinken was aiming to de-escalate the tensions near Ukraine's eastern border, where Russia has amassed around 150,000 troops, according to estimates, and Lavrov sought guarantees that Ukraine wouldn't be allowed to join NATO, which Russia says would pose a security threat. Lavrov said on Friday that Russia has no immediate plans to attack Ukraine. This is USA Radio News. A winter storm is bringing significant ice and snow to portions of the southeast and mid-Atlantic coast. It's been causing major travel disruptions. Residents are not out of the woods as a blast of Arctic air will bring the threat for a rapid freeze-up. Ice and snow hampered travel in cities like Raleigh, North Carolina, where a Delta Airlines flight skidded off the runway at Raleigh-Durham International Airport on Friday night. Meteorologists are saying watch out for ice as temperatures are going to drop overnight. There are warnings out in cities from Salisbury, Maryland to Norfolk, Virginia, and even into northern South Carolina. The rapid freezing overnight could cause major travel delays with ice building up on the roadways. Also, major airports in the area are expecting flight delays and cancellations due to the storm. You're listening to USA Radio News.
Life can be full of risks. One thing you shouldn't take a risk with ever is your family's health insurance. If you're self-employed or you now need affordable health insurance, you need to make this free call right now and see how the Health Insurance Helpline can help you get it. We specialize in helping the self-employed and people just like you that need affordable health insurance to get it. We have short and long-term health insurance plans, and some even cover dental, vision, and prescription drugs. Don't take a risk with your family's health insurance. It's not worth it. If you're self-employed or now need affordable health insurance, call right now and learn for free how to get it. Listen, affordable health insurance plans for everyone just like you are a free phone call away. So give us a shout right now.
800-670-0946. 800-670-0946. 800-670-0946. That's 800-670-0946.
This is Micah Hanks of the Gray Alien Report, and you're listening to the Paracast, the gold standard of paranormal radio.
We are back with Kevin Randall, longtime UFO investigator, talking about Levelin, this new book published by Flying Disc Press. Kirk Collins, you had a question.
Yeah, so you mentioned the press given Saucedo, is that his name, that they were ridiculing his name. So tell us what was the this term, Wetnik, what was that all about?
In October of 1957, the Soviets launched their first artificial satellite, Sputnik. And then, coincidentally, on November 2nd, they launched their second one with the dog on board, another Sputnik. So they were using the term Wetnik to kind of ridicule the idea of the flying saucer. They were using those sorts of terms to ridicule it. I know in 1947, for example, there was a headline from Kansas that said, "Flying saucers now seen in 38 states except Kansas." And the joke was Kansas was a dry state, meaning they didn't have legal sales of alcohol. And so they didn't have drunks seeing these things in the sky. So when you look at terms like Wetnik or what is it or how they put all those things together, it's kind of a term to belittle it a little bit and make it sound like it's a bunch of rubes seeing something that they can't identify, or rubes making up things or seeing, having hallucinations, that kind of thing. It's a way of kind of ridiculing the whole idea.
Yeah, I think they were also trying to play it off as that the public was space crazy, too.
You have to understand that the idea of the Sputnik kind of grabbed attention when the Soviets launched the thing. But by the time you get to November 2nd, it's been a month. And so that kind of craze is over. So now they put up the Sputnik with the dog, but nobody knew it because the news hadn't been released around the world at that time. So when you kind of suggest it's a hysteria on the parts of the people of Levelland, you have to ask yourself two questions. Had they really heard about the second launch of the Sputnik? And two, Why is it only Levelland at that particular time that's having this problem? Yeah, it kind of spreads out from there. I think the peak of the wave, if I remember correctly, was like November 6th. So it peaked very quickly and then dropped off. But you had an awful lot of the sightings where you had the cars being stalled. If you go back a little bit further in history to 1954, there's an awful lot of these kinds of sightings in France and South America, but they didn't get a lot of play in the United States because it's France and South America. And so it's kind of a new phenomenon with the stalling of the car engines or the interaction with the UFOs in that respect in the United States in 1957. But there is a historical precedent set in France and South America. And that is covered in the book as well, showing how those sightings differed somewhat from the sightings in the United States and the reporting of it and the response of the local police and the local governments to those sorts of sightings as opposed to the way the United States Air Force reacted to them.
You know, I have one quick question which always occurs to me with these EM effects. And I'm considering what we saw in Close Encounters of the Third Kind. In the real world, the UFO comes close, the car engine stalls or whatever. Does it spontaneously start up after the UFO leaves, or do they have to manually restart the car?
Well, that's a question that nobody's really asked. One of the reasons the Condon Committee rejected the idea of these electromagnetic effects is because they knew of no physical law that would allow the engine to restart spontaneously. They could understand how a very strong magnetic field could suppress the engine, but they knew of no way that it would just start spontaneously. And that was one of the things I looked at is going through all these sorts of cases, how many people said the engine started spontaneously, and a few did. But most of the cases, the driver had to take some action to restart the car. I think in Levelland, there was one case where the guy said that he insisted, I think it was James Long, insisted that he had started the car, but the others say when the UFO left, then the car could be started, or I started the car. So there's a limited number of cases where it is reported it started spontaneously, but in the majority of them, the drivers took some action to get the car to start.
There was now your book touches on a number of other topics. You know, it probably ought to be called Levelland and Beyond. But so there was a couple of sections in there about UFO detectors. Now, of course, you know, can't give away everything in the book, but give us a taste of what that's about.
I think Jim Lorenzen, in talking to some other people and realizing there was a strong magnetic field associated with some UFO sightings, decided that you could use that to detect a UFO. So he created, I think with a number of other people, Jim was something of an engineer, and created a metal detector which more or less is a magnetometer. So that if there was a presence of a strong magnetic field, the detector would go off and you could run outside and see if there was a flying saucer. Fran Ridge, who runs the NICAP site, has taken it a step further and created a system of stations, what he calls nodes, around the country. And they use a number of different sensors to detect UFOs, not only magnetism, but compass deviations and other changes to the environment that might suggest some kind of a UFO coming by. And then they collect that data electronically, or collect that data without human intervention, and then compare those node alerts against sighting reports in the area, and they find some correlations. Not as many as I would have thought, but they do find some correlations between a sighting of a UFO that's reported independently and a detection alert from one of the nodes, one of the nodes nearby. I had suggested that they make sure that the operators of the nodes have a camera handy to take photographs and run outside and take photographs. And I also suggested that maybe they could set up a network around their node of people that if they get a detection, they could go outside and look, and you could end up with photographs from separate locations sort of independently taken. I thought that was a brilliant idea on my part, but of course Fran Ridge had already thought of that, so I think he gets credit for that as well. But I mean, that's one of the things they're doing, and that kind of leads us back to Avi Loeb because when I was talking to Avi Loeb about this, and he was talking about wanting instrumentality to detect the alien artifacts without human assistance in that, because it would make the data much more precise, I suppose. I mentioned this sort of thing, and he just didn't want to deal with UFOs, and he was, I think he felt that the collection of the data wouldn't be as scientifically rigorous as what they would set up to try to detect these objects moving through our solar system. But I thought it was a great idea, and Fran Ridge has been working on this for years, setting up these nodes not only around the United States but in some other countries as well, in an attempt to detect UFOs. So they're using some of the observations made at Level Land, of course, but other areas to design this sensor arrays and to detect the UFOs passing close to the nodes.
I always think, though, if they set up these UFO detectors, what will happen is the UFOs will go elsewhere.
Well, that suggests that there's some kind of spying on the human race by the UFOs. They've had some luck with that, detecting things that are cross-correlated with UFO sightings. They do get... The detectors do go off periodically when there's nothing around. I mean, if there's something else triggers one of the other sensors, and they're well aware of that thing, and they're always working to calibrate things more precisely to get it directly toward the UFOs. But I don't think there's any real evidence that the UFOs would go somewhere else. And besides that, the nodes are becoming somewhat ubiquitous. I think in the book there's a map of where the nodes are, and they're pretty much all over the United States. Yeah, there's great gaps in where they are, but they're always putting up new nodes elsewhere and recalibrating the information and recalibrating the systems to make sure that the information collected is as scientifically precise as it can be.
We'll be more than scientific and precise because we have Kevin Randall and we have Kurt Collins. I'm Gene Steinberg. I never claimed to be a scientist, and I won't say what I am because people will dispute it. Seriously, you're in the Paracast.
Thank you for listening to GCN. Visit GCNlive.com today.
Do you need a website? Well, you can get a great deal on hosting services with Namecheap's legendary coupon code. They're offering substantial hosting discounts on shared hosting, business hosting, VPS hosting, reseller hosting, and even dedicated servers. Namecheap is preferred by millions. It's backed by a money-back guarantee. Use the coupon code LEGENDARY to cash in on this special deal at Namecheap.com, Namecheap.com.
First came Attack of the Rockoids, and it was a critically acclaimed success. And now there is The Coming of the Protectors. A former military intelligence man is contacted by a space woman in a dream that turns out to be a nightmare, because evil forces on her distant planet are planning to conquer the Earth. This is gripping science fiction of the classic kind. Attack of the Rockoids and The Coming of the Protectors. Find out more at Rockoids.com. That's Rockoids, Rockoids.com.
If you're concerned about the power grid and want to generate your own supply of off-grid electricity, this will be the most important message you'll hear this year. Here's why. We now have a small number of solar generators back in stock. These emergency backup systems provide life-saving backup power when you need it most. And unlike gas generators, solar generators run quietly, emit no dangerous fumes, and produce an endless supply of free electricity from the sun. Whether it's wildfires, dangerous weather, power grid issues, or just getting off the grid, you'll never have to suffer through painful power outages again. Even better, all this week, radio listeners get over $700 in free off-the-grid bonuses, too. Go to MySolarBackup.com to learn more and check availability. That's MySolarBackup.com. Look for the free report, Crisis Cooling, how to make absolutely sure your meat, milk, and medicines stay safe and cool in any power outage. Yours free at MySolarBackup.com.
Jake was in big trouble with the IRS. He owed how much?
$92,000.
$1,000.
Ouch. The IRS left no room for Jake to breathe.
They put a lien on my house, took all the money out of my bank account, took money out of my paychecks. So it was a nightmare.
He needed help fast.
I figured that all these companies were the same until I called Federal Tax Management. You could just tell they knew what they were talking about. Right then and there, I felt like I had some hope.
Stop the liens, levies, and garnishments fast and qualify for one of several special IRS programs that could reduce or even eliminate your tax debt. So, how'd it go for Jake?
They did what they said they would do. They came through for me. I ended up saving an unbelievable amount. I was so jazzed. I was extremely happy.
If you owe more than $10,000 in back taxes, take Jake's advice.
Give Federal Tax Management a phone call. If they help me, they can help anybody.
Call the Federal Tax Management Hotline now. 800-503-8625. 800-503-8625. 800-503-8625.
Extend your life with Extendovite.
Extendovite really works. Here are some reviews from Amazon.com. John Hess, 5 out of 5 stars. Awesome. Probably my only review, but at age 40, I was getting bad heart throb and left arm pain, mainly before bed. I even stopped smoking and drinking sodas for a month, and that didn't work. After one day of taking Extendivite, it was gone and hasn't returned in 3 years. I've ordered Extendivite 13 times, so Amazon just said. Juliet Hordick. I've ordered this product before in liquid form. It is fantastic. My whole family's been on it. To order, call 1-877-928-8822. That's 1-877-928-8822. Or visit our website at heartdrop.com.
Extend your life with Extendovite.
This is Big the Merciless. You are listening to the Paracast, the gold standard of paranormal radio, exactly according to my plan.
We continue. Kevin Randall, he is the author of a new book on Leveland, but it's not just about that one case, but about other sightings with similar details. He will also be back for after the Paracast, where we might just ask him about yet another Roswell book, but not now. Now, after the Paracast, by the way, is an exclusive feature of the Paracast Plus. We also offer this show free of the network ads with higher quality audio, and it's all available if you check out theparacast.plus. Once again, visit theparacast.plus for quick sign-up instructions. Kurt, you had a question.
Yeah, let's give him a hard time. So now most of the book is about very credible cases and probably things you could present to the scientists, but there are a couple of cases in there with electromagnetic effects that involved UFO occupant sightings. And I was kind of surprised to see those in there. So what can you say about those and how credible do you think they are?
Most of the sightings where we get the occupants involved are foreign sightings from France and from South America. And that becomes problematic when you start talking about the occupants with the creatures. But if you're going to suggest that there's a flying saucer from another planet here and it's getting close enough to the ground to land, you're going to have to expect that you get some sighting reports of the UFO occupants. And I find, those sightings to be credible as well, especially when there's multiple witnesses to it. Some of them, single witness or just two or three witnesses, but some of them are multiple witness to the UFO or to the occupants. And then there's some sightings in there that involve the reactions of animals to the UFOs as well. So I wanted to look at the whole thing and present as much of the data as I could. And it's kind of a tribute to Len Springfield. In talking to Len Springfield back when he was collecting his sighting reports of crash retrievals, as he called them, I asked him sort of a similar question. And he said that he didn't have a time to investigate all of the cases, but he thought if he put the information out there that others would become interested in it and would take that information and continue on the investigation and maybe find something more, taking it in another direction. I looked at those cases from a number of sources that such as Jacques Vallée's earlier books on UFOs and that sort of thing. I mean, Jacques Vallée's books, I looked at Mark Rodica's work on vehicle interference cases and that sort of thing. So I looked at a lot of that sort of thing to look at the cases, but I thought it important to report on the reactions of people to seeing the creatures as well. Now, there was a sighting in Brooksville, Florida, by a guy named, I want to say James Reese, but that doesn't sound right. Anyhow, he reported seeing an object on the ground, and the occupant on it, and looked like he took a picture of him. You know, there was a flash at the guy's chest, and he thought they were taking photographs. Reese's sightings are problematic, but the thing is, I happened to be in Brooksville, Florida, not long after those sightings took place, because I was in at Fort Rucker in flight school, and we would get, by the time we got toward the end of flight school, we got the weekends off, and a couple of friends of mine and I went down to Brooksville, Florida to talk about this sort of thing. We talked to the deputy sheriff down there, and what he told me was that the papers that Reeves found laying on the ground with a strange writing on it was given to the Air Force, and the papers that the Air Force brought back were not the same, that they had... the Air Force had faked the papers, and the deputy told me that they had cut a small corner off one of the papers, and they touched a match to it, and it flared up like flash paper, and the papers brought back didn't do that. So now I've got a case where we've got a fellow with not the most credible background reporting an occupant sighting with landing traces and these papers, and you think, well, we can write this whole thing off because the guy was a loon, but then you learn that the sheriff's deputies that investigated it, thought he was somewhat more credible, and you see some more manipulation by the government with the evidence. So, you know, you've got to take a look at all of that. So, you know, I looked at the cases, and there were some I just ignored because I just could not find them credible. But the ones I put in the book were the ones I found interesting enough that I thought they should be included.
Let me ask you a question here. Going into this project, and I know you've been chasing footnotes for years, trying to go back into sighting reports, especially older ones, to try to get the accurate facts. Was there anything about all this that surprised you, that changed your expectations?
The surprising thing was to find evidence of the Air Force officers being involved. Because if you look at the information that had passed from the past, what people wrote about and that sort of thing, the Air Force role is obscured. Yeah, we knew about the investigator coming in from Colorado Springs, and the newspapers reported on the provost marshal from Reese Air Force Base being out with working with the sheriff. I did not expect to find limited evidence of Air Force participation on the night of the sightings, that they were out there and probably close enough to have their car engine stalled. That was surprising, and finding some of those things. And looking at the information that was available on these sightings through all kinds of sources, the Air Force, for example, said that the weather in Leveland that night was rainy and drizzly and not all that great with a low ceiling. But included in the report is a weather report from one of the weather reporting stations, saying that by the time you end up with the sightings, the weather was clear. The rain was gone. There was no drizzle. The cloud cover was like 4/10 of the sky. And those of you who are pilots know when you say the cloud cover is 4/10, it doesn't mean they're all at the same level. So it's not like 4/10 of the sky was obscured. It's different layers and that sort of thing. So you had a good view of the sky that night as well. So those sorts of things were surprising. And some of the things I found in the Air Force file that contradicted other things in the Air Force file were surprising, because I know that they sort of sanitize these things before they put them out. And I also know that they also thought, they believed at the time that they were making the files, 1957 for Leveland, for example, that none of us would ever see them. They would be locked away in a cabinet or destroyed at some point. We'd never see them. So I was surprised at some of the things I found in the Air Force file that contradicted other things in the Air Force file. For example, in one place, as I mentioned, the Air Force said, well, only three people saw the object. But another place, the file talks about five people seeing the object. So they kind of contradicted themselves in that in the file as well, and looking at that sort of thing. So and the other thing that surprised me was when we get over to the White Sand sighting in Oro Grande with James Stokes, The Air Force interviewed three of the MPs who saw the UFO. The fourth MP was not available, and they said he'd gone on a three-day pass. And I'm thinking, excuse me? He went on a three-day pass? You're giving him a three-day pass here after he's been involved in this UFO thing and, you know, the Air Force is coming? And there's some information that suggests the guy was in the hospital because he had been burned by the close approach of the UFO. And we had Stokes, you know, talking about a slight rash that he developed because of the UFO. So we have that sort of thing. I don't know why the other guy didn't develop a rash. But
going back to Stokes for a second. All right, so yes. He developed a slight rash. Any indication of any other physical effects?
Well, his car engine stalled.
Well, I'm not thinking of the car engine. I'm thinking in terms of his own self.
Well, no, the only thing was it was described as a light sunburn, a reddening of the skin, and if you remember Close Encounters of the Third Kind, when Dreyfus was in his pickup truck, one of his arms got burned and half of his face got sunburned. That's kind of what Stokes was. He had a reddening of the skin on one arm and part of his face. By the time the Air Force got around to talk to him, that had all faded away.
So he had no subsequent physical effects, or at least nothing was mentioned.
No. And he was a friend of the Lorenzans, and had there been subsequent physical manifestations, whatever they might have been, Cora Lorenzen would have reported on that, and she never did.
You see, when you go through Levelin and other cases, I kind of get the impression that Major Donald Kehoe, because in his books I first learned about this, wasn't really a terribly crack investigator. You know, a lot of his reports in the books were anecdotes, lots of conversations back and forth that he remembered and wrote it like a pulp fiction novel. And he didn't probe deeply enough into any of these things. We get the surface details. We get the details about the fact that he and the Air Force disagreed about the number of witnesses, things like that. But he didn't delve real deep into any of this that I recall. I mean, it's a lot of years since I read his books, but I don't recall him being a really crack investigator. We've got Kurt, we've got Kevin, both crack investigators, and we've got Gene, who asks the questions. You're in
the Paracast.
Thank you for listening to GCN. Visit GCNlive.com today.
Attack of the Rockoids has been well received by critics and readers alike. It's a thrill-a-minute story you'll never forget. A former U.S. military intelligence officer is haunted by intense dreams about a beautiful woman pleading for his help after a terrible battle in outer space. But the dreams turn out to be true and thrust him into a telepathic love affair with a woman whose faraway planet is intent on destroying the Earth. And now the gripping tale continues in The Coming of the Protectors. It's the second book of the Rockoids trilogy, a galaxy-spanning adventure that pits our hapless heroes against powerful, fanatical enemies that threaten the lives of freedom-loving beings everywhere. Attack of the Rockoids and The Coming of the Protectors, classic science fiction at its best, available now. For more details, visit Rockoids.com. That's Rockoids.com.
Hi, Peter Vaccaro for ParanormalDate.com. Are you looking for love in all the wrong places? Now you have a chance to change that by signing up for free at ParanormalDate.com. This incredible dating site puts people of like minds together. People who are interested in the strange, the unusual, mysteries, ghosts, UFOs, and the afterlife, and so much more. ParanormalDate.com was developed for you, people seeking a viable alternative to the other dating services. You can join for free by going to ParanormalDate.com, and if you decide you like it and want to connect with people, use the code GEORGE for a substantial discount. Mark Rawlings, president of ParanormalDate.com, says so many people hunger to share their experiences about the paranormal, the unexplainable, or the afterlife, and so much more, and this is the source for them to meet and share that common interest. So sign up for free at ParanormalDate.com. ParanormalDate.com. And use the code GEORGE if you decide to connect with someone you like.